Welcome, thinkers, to Season 4, Episode 21 of Thinking Critically. As usual, a couple of things up front. Number one, please continue to listen to Dungeons, Dice and Dudes, where you can see me as a player, DDND Pod, on all socials and Twitch. Every Sunday, we are either streaming live or rerunning the previous live stream, and it's some of the most fun I've ever had. So go and check it out. Quinn is great. Otherwise, the other big news is this is the last episode before my 12-plus hour charity stream for Naomi House and Jack's Place Children's Hospice here in the UK. Friday the 24th of March, starting at 10 a.m. UK time, I will be going through a series of challenges and forfeits, trying to complete the new Resident Evil 4 remake, which releases on the same day, makes it easy to remember, and trying to smash some donation goals. I want to double last year's. So those who tuned in last year's, we're going bigger, we're going louder, we're going more painful. So if you want to see me do a bunch of goofy stuff all in the aid of a great cause, please do check out my Twitch stream, twitch.tv/thinkcritdnd. As usual, links will be in the episode description, but that's I'm really looking forward to that, and I really want to make it a big deal, so any support you can do would be greatly appreciated. Otherwise, let's get on with the show. And today I'm joined by Michael Ross from the RPG Academy. Thank you ever so much for joining us today, Michael. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Of course, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me on. So my name is Michael. I am the host of the RPG Academy podcast. We have been podcasting about role-playing games for going on 12 years. We have a bunch of different types of shows, from interviews with creators, actual play content, GM theory, discussion, even some movie reviews and movie deep dives and how media can influence RPGs. If you like RPGs and podcasts, we probably have some sort of show that you would like.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, from one podcaster to another. Today's topic is mystery. Ooh, so what does that mean to you in the D&D and wider TTRPG framework?
Okay, so I absolutely love mysteries just as a genre. It's one of my favorite things to do in any sort of role-playing game is to do the typical murder mystery. And not all mysteries have to be murder-related, but it happens a lot. And I just really enjoy the aspects of trying to figure out how we can get a mystery and the solving of mysteries to be entertaining and engaging within the RPG or D&D framework. And I know that a lot of people have said that D&D isn't a good system for running mysteries. And there have been many systems designed specifically to try to tackle that sort of not quite fitting perfectly within the scheme of how the game works. I have successfully ran mysteries, and I think it can be done within D&D, but I think there's a bit of a framework understanding of, hey, we're playing this particular type of game and how we're doing it. But I'm interested to hear your side as well. But I'll just say I love mysteries. I'm excited to talk about them in big picture. But it's really anything that can be discovered through play. It doesn't have to be who killed this particular person. It could be, why is this happening? Why is it happening now? What is the cause of this? You know, where do we need to go? Any sort of information that can be discovered through play, role play, dice play, you know, mechanics, to me works as the fundamentals of a mystery. But when it's a central theme to a particular session or section of a campaign, I really, really enjoy that type of play.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up that comment there. People have said before that D&D isn't maybe the best vehicle for that kind of stuff. And yes, something I've absolutely heard. But as with most things, it just needs a little bit of consideration, right? A little bit of thought, and you can make it work. And the reason why I'm saying that is because there's the rule of three is the one I'm going to, as the obvious one I'm going to start with. There are very many tools and tricks and tips you can use to aid in those sessions, which aren't just, I smash the skeleton with my mace, I cast fireball, move on to the next room.
Right.
So let's talk about murder mysteries then, seeing as you started with it and you seem that's one of your preferred avenues. Have I done that one? No, I don't think I have. I think if I'm being brutally honest, I've probably stayed away from like your typical noir mysteries, probably because of insecurity about how well I'll be able to pull it off.
Yeah. It is difficult, again, especially in D&D, because depending on what level you're playing, there are so many ways and tools and abilities and, be honest, spells that can just destroy a murder mystery. Like if you design a murder mystery and the player has a spell that lets them rewind and watch time, they can see who did it, or they have the ability to speak to the dead. Either the dead can't know who did it, or it has to have some reason that it would then lie to you if the spell doesn't force compulsion truth-telling. So those are some of the big considerations you have to be worried about is what level are you dealing with this mystery, and what abilities do your characters have that maybe your players don't that would just solve the mystery? And you just have to account for those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which actually now you've explained it, I was trying to think about the other pillars of D&D and how combat takes, it's a very similar thought process to combat. In my head, I've always kind of disassociated the social side of things, the mystery side of things, and combat have been two separate kind of thought processes, trains of preparation. However, what you've just described is very similar to what you have to do for when you're dealing with high level combat. It's, well, the mage has banishment, so will completely remove one of these creatures from the fight, and the monk can run up walls, or can, you know, we've got a really good ranged person, so that means the flyers are now not really a threat anymore. It's that same thought process now I'm thinking about it. It's not actually too dissimilar. I used to think they were very dissimilar, but now we've kind of brought them together, and it scratches that same kind of itch of how do I account for the player character abilities in such a way as to not diminish them, but to in some respects, you know, enable them in some cases. But I really love that. Why would the dead person, if you ask them who did it, lie? That is such a great hook. I feel like that's been in a million UK British TV dramas of like, why would the victim lie about whoever's committed a crime against them? That's such a good little twist.
Right. I think part of it could be, I mean, again, and this is literally just off the top of the head, so please forgive how rudimentary it would be, but, you know, you could have something where you have, like, a noble person, and I don't know if there's things like insurance in D&D. It's your game, you do you, but maybe it's a situation where the person died, was wealthy, all their money will go to their family, but maybe it was their spouse who killed them, and that would invalidate that insurance claim, so they would rather the murderer go free because their family's taken care of rather than get caught. You know, maybe it's like I have family, I have kids that I want to take care of. So even though my spouse did it, I still want my kids to have money. So you could come up with some way that makes sense for them to have a reason to lie. And then maybe the mystery isn't how do we solve the mystery? We already know that is how do we find a way to bring the person who did it to justice while not invalidating the wishes of the deceased?
Yeah, brilliant. Well, we're only like 5 minutes in, and that's such a great, I love that, such a great setup. I can only hope that at least one listener is going to hear that and go, great, I'm going to try and bring that into my game.
If anyone takes anything I say and use it, please let me know, because I sometimes feel like I'm talking into a void. So I would love for someone to go, even if something I said is like, oh, that's really dumb, but the dumbness caused you to think of something smart, tell me that too.
I know that pain. That's the pain of being online in 2023 is screaming into the void. So yes, absolutely. So yeah, I'm just trying to think. So as mentioned, I've never done any stereotypical mysteries, but the more I think about it, the more even things as trivial as like a quote unquote puzzle in a room or something is a mystery in micro. It's a microcosm of a mystery. In that there's something is the players don't have all the pieces of the puzzle. They don't have all the information to be able to push the button or turn the dials in the right way or get the sequence in the right order until they've worked something out. So I guess the train of thought there for both puzzle design and wider mystery design. Here we go. Is a mystery just a series of puzzles? Maybe.
It certainly could be. If you wanted to string them together, I think for me, one of the satisfying parts of a mystery, and I kind of equate this a lot to movies, if you've watched movies or, you know, shows about mysteries, is most of the time there is a trail that maybe even on a rewatch, maybe you don't catch it in real time, but maybe once you know the solution, you go back and rewatch it and you're like, oh, okay, there were clues when this happened and when this happened. So it needs to be solvable by the players, I think, to be a truly satisfying mystery. If they go through the entire adventure and at the end it's a character we've never met before, a character who's never been mentioned before, sure, that might qualify as a mystery if that's what actually happened. But that's not going to be very fun. It's going to feel like a cheat in a way. So there has to be some sort of pattern that upon review, okay, we learned that the killer was left-handed. We learned that the killer was taller than the victim. We learned that the killer had recently been to the rock quarry. Then the killer needs to be a left-handed tall person who worked in the quarry, or it's just not going to make sense.
Yeah, yeah, the classic, oh, you never saw this coming because it's actually somebody else from out of town who just turned up for the day. that's classic 101 ways to disappoint your disappoint the players or the readers or the watchers or whatever it is to completely blindside them with. I've had that feeling before when I've watched stuff or played video games before and been like, how would I ever have got that?
Right.
That feeling is like, well, you just wasted my time.
Right. Because again, it's not fun. And again, I equate a lot of things to movies because I'm also a big movie watcher. And sometimes it's easy to figure out who a killer is in a TV show because of the conceits of a TV show. Like if we see a cold open and there's a murder that happens in cold open, but we do not see the face of the murderer, then I guarantee that is someone that we meet in Act One. Because otherwise they would have showed us their face, but they didn't show us their face because it's going to be a character that we follow throughout the entire show. So then it's like, okay, well, clearly it's that person. Like you can solve the mystery so easy. You know, keeping those sort of like tropes in mind, you can play around with the structure of D&D as well, where you could have a vision. Like one of the characters has a vision sent to them by a divine source or magic item, and they see like a cold open of the murder, but they don't see the face of the person. They're probably going to assume it's someone that they know because that's why we didn't see their face. So you can kind of like not manipulate, but you can control an information source back and forth to help you conceal or in some cases reveal. Because you already mentioned the rule of three. If anyone isn't familiar with that, basically you should lay at least three clues for every solution. Otherwise your players are going to miss them. Because no matter how obvious you think the solution is, your players are not as on the same page you are.
Yep. I just got this image in my head now of the murderer being like, it was me, literally I did it. Nah, he's lying, wasn't him. See, that's where one clue's not enough.
Yeah, I mean, you could have like the homeless person or the equivalent vagrant on the street who's like, you know, covered in whiskey, and he's like, I did it, I saw the, it was me, and then they dismiss them, and then actually it was the bad person in disguise the entire time.
Yep. What other than, so now we're talking about the rule of three. I want to loop back to that using the trope of like a murder mystery on television. But outside of the rule of three, then what other classic in your experience have you found or used those classic tips and tricks and tools to be able to help ensure, of course, because you never be absolutely certain that it will be a success, but help ensure that the players are going to have a rewarding time.
So I have a couple actual guidelines, and then I have the truth. but the truth may feel bad to some people, so I'm going to cover that one last. You need a red herring. Like, that's just classic murder mystery 101. There's going to be early evidence that appears to point directly at someone, and then it can't actually be that person. And usually you find out it's not that person, because when you go to confront that person, they are also dead. So, you know, you found three clues. Clearly, it's Lord Bernard. He's got to be the murderer. We're going to go to the manor, confront him. Oh, crap, he's dead in the same exact method of murder as our first victim. Apparently, it wasn't them. Very classic murder mystery trope. Again, if you're playing a session long enough to have that sort of misdirect, I highly encourage it. I think there's a trope, especially in role-playing games like D&D, where you're like a ball, or there's some sort of party where everyone, once the murder happens, no one can leave. And the game is going from person to person, trying to get the information, figure out who didn't like who had motivation, who had opportunity.
Yeah.
And within the confines of D&D, you're going to have players who are like, well, I have 37 plus insight. I'm just going to ask everyone directly, did they murder the person? And then they're going to go to their dice. That's the way D&D works, but it's not very fun. So what I would do there is I would use scaling difficulty levels. So like if I'm just going to walk right up and ask someone, did you murder this person? The DC on that might be like 35, which even in fifth edition high levels, that's a pretty high number to get to. Mm. But if they have talked to at least three other people, then it goes to 30 or to 25. If they've talked to five other people, it goes from 25 to 20. So mechanically, I'm building in an incentive to you need to go to talk to everybody. So we get these role play scenes. So the people who are just good at that sort of investigative type, they're going to start putting clues together that then modifies the role. So you're working with them together rather than two separate mechanisms you're working with, the true role players and then the people who like to roll dice, which I think both are welcome at my table. But I like it when it blends together. But here's the truth of the matter. A lot of times I will run mysteries where I don't actually know who the killer is. I will just start throwing out random elements. And then when they put together something that makes sense, they're right.
Oh, was that the bit that people aren't going to like?
Yeah. So that's more for the DMs than the players. But yeah, sometimes that's how we run mysteries as DMs. Because if you've watched a movie like Glass Onion or Knives Out or any, you know, Hercule Poirot, those novels were written and rewritten and edited and rewritten and re-edited before they ever got published. We are trying to tell a murder mystery in real time, first draft only. We are going to screw up. At least I am. Mm. You or the general you audience might be better at it than I am, probably are. So sometimes, not all the time, especially if I'm designing a session that's going to be a mystery, I'm going to put the work in. But if it sort of just kind of emerges in play, I might just start going, it definitely looks like the killer must have been left-handed. There's all these witnesses are saying that they saw someone with these very vibrant green eyes. Like that's the only detail they remember. This person looked kind of normal, but they just really bright, striking green eyes. I don't know what those mean yet, but later on, somebody will put something together and I'll be like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And then they're right all along and that's the killer. And as long as it's like a magic show. As long as no one sees how the trick is done, it's magic. But if they see through it, unless you're going for comedy like Penn and Teller, it's not going to work. So you have to be confident that you can improv around things. And I feel like that's one of my strengths. I'm much better at improv than I am encounter design. So I lean into improv over encounter design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is reassuring to me. And I hope some of my listeners, because as I said earlier on, one of the reasons why I haven't done a classic mystery, not murder, whatever it is, theft, whatever it might be, is because I was always scared that I didn't have the skill set or the confidence or whatnot. But I improvise a lot at the table because I'm fortunate enough that my players are very inventive in their questions. When just regular adventuring, they're always like, oh, but is there a fire exit here? Or can I go into the bathrooms to put a disguise on? Regular listeners of the show will know the anecdote of, I wanted to get into this later on, but there was a masquerade ball which did have elements of a murder mystery into it. But long story short is at that point, I had a map drawn out because I wanted it to be that level of detail. And one of the first questions somebody asked was, can I go into the bathroom to put a disguise on? And I was like, crap, I didn't put that on the map. So quickly had to annotate on with like the pen tool, just like draw a squiggly line that was like, took a chunk out of one of the rooms. I was like, that's now the restrooms, I guess. And the running joke is now that every time they go into a new place with a new map, they're always like, yeah, where are the bathrooms? They're down low. And I'm like, ah, yes, I know now. There's so many bathrooms. There's two bathrooms per person in this building.
It was just recently renovated. The blueprints hadn't been updated. That's why it was not.
So like another example recently is they were in a big, I kind of blend not sci-fi, but more modern trappings into my situation. I like the convenience of lifts and escalators and being able to communicate over distances quite easily. That just aids convenience without breaking too much of the...
Have you played Eberron?
No.
Eberron is my favorite D&D setting, and it does sort of incorporate those... They're magically based rather than technology based, but you have things like trains and sky cabs and elevators and lifts. All that stuff is built in through magic, not technology. It's my favorite D&D setting to play in.
Yeah. So basically I'm inspired by that. And there was a big tower. Think of it like a TV tower in Tokyo or something, you know, like those big towers that dominate the skylines in metropolises. And There's a lift in the center of it that takes them up to the top, and there's a viewing platform, literally north, south, east, west, little binoculars to go and view the the countryside and stuff around it. And that was it. That's as much thought as I put into it. I was like, they're going to go in, there's a lift. It's like a freight lift, but kind of customer facing as well. Then get to the lift at the top. I was like, I don't know how it works. I don't really care how it works. It's just a lift because that's all it needs to be right now.
Sure.
And again, thanks to my players, they wanted to stop the lift because there was another group of adventurers that they wanted to talk to who were getting the lift down. And they were like, well, I cast Dispel Magic on the elevator shaft. And then that was, and I'm tooting my own torn horn here, but I was like, yeah, I guess that'll shut down the lift because it's probably like in my head, this is out loud. I'm like, yeah, of course that shuts down the lift. You've well done, player. But in my head, I'm like, fine. Allow it. That's good. And then again, so someone else was like, well, the lift doesn't work. So we'll get there must be like a way to get down from this roof in the case of an emergency. So I was like, yeah, there's a hatch on the floor that opens up into, you know, a gantry stairwell all the way down, but it's a long way to run down.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. So this talk has reassured me in that I could definitely do a more typical mystery because of, you know, the years of playing D&D with these inventive players has trained me to to be able to improvise.
And from the player side, just to restate it, is if the DM does a good job, then there's no difference to the player. Like, it's going to look and feel exactly the same on the player side, as long as you never tell them. Like, and just, that's the way it works. And I equate this to, sometimes I'll tell a joke to my friends in like a fake first person. Like, oh, the other day I was on the train and this happened. I was never on the train, but it's part of the joke. It's part of the setup that I have to be in first person to tell this joke. And I'm telling it not to be mean and manipulate and lie to my friends. I'm doing it because I'm trying to tell them a joke to make them laugh. So this sort of like slight dishonesty from a DM standpoint, I think is part of the job. Like, I absolutely feel like, you know, I'm doing this to make the game fun. I'm never doing this to punish my players and to trick them and make them wrong. Like, oh, they solved my mystery too soon. I'm going to change it. No, I would not do that. I just don't know who did it yet. And we're 10 minutes in the session, so it's going to be someone different because I think it would be more fun. Some people may completely disagree with that. It's very similar to like fudging dice or adding hit points or changing, you know, combat stats in the middle. Some people are like, sure, whatever. Other people are like, no, the sanctity of the dice must be maintained. Your table is your table. I'm not going to come to your table and force you to do it my way. But I will tell you that I've done it my way for many years and my players enjoy it and we have a good time. So at least for us, this way works. And I've absolutely ran mysteries both ways where I know exactly who did it. I have the clues written down ahead of time. I lay them out. And then I've also done it where I'm just making stuff up as I go. And we've had fun both ways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you've brought up several quite interesting topics there that are tangentially related to mystery. I did want to touch upon them quickly is... putting me myself on the spot now, I do think in my heart of hearts that improvisation in the examples we've discussed in terms of like, ooh, could I have that lift be mechanically powered? But then no, that kind of, right, it's magically powered on the spot. Fine, Dispel Magic works, lift stops, fine. Is different to fudging dice. I think there is, I can't eloquently describe it, but there is some kind of inherent difference between those two forms of quote-unquote dishonesty. Now detractors of what I've just said will say, well, they're both serving a story, so maybe they are the same, but you can prepare better for combat, for, you know, failing forward. The solutions are perhaps simpler. You know, they don't murder you, they capture you. It's not a TPK if you get knocked down, whatever, they imprison you, you know, whatever it may be. Those solutions are typically simpler than it is to quickly work out how a lift works, for example, or quickly put together a murder mystery in the 30s. Oh, let's take a quick toilet break, shall we? In the four minutes while you're not actually on the toilet, you're just trying to read five novels to get inspiration from them to be able to put together a compelling story. Now, in both instances, what the players don't know doesn't hurt them. So if they don't know you're fudging, then doesn't, you know. But I'm struggling to defend my point of view, but it does feel like there is a difference. Like if at the end of the murder mystery or whatever it may be, you reveal it to be the person they've successfully guessed and everyone's like jumping out of their chairs, cheering and laughing and being like, oh, that's the best session I ever had, then I guess that's a success.
Right. So at the RPG Academy, we have a motto. We've had this motto for like 11 and a half years. It's called, if you're having fun, you're doing it right. And we absolutely believe that. So at your table, if the DM never fudges the dice, every roll is in front of the players, they never change combat stats, you know, you think of every strict raw by the book rule you can think of. If everyone at the table is having a great time doing that, you are absolutely playing D&D correctly. At the same time, if you're playing at a table where you go three sessions and no one rolls a dice and you're basically playing a LARP and you start doing like, you know, paper, rock, scissors to see who wins in combat, if everyone had a good time, you played D&D correctly. Like that's absolutely my belief. And I do mean everyone. So if you got three people who love it, one person who hates it, that doesn't count. But if everyone at that session had a great time and they cannot wait to come back and play again, then you're an amazing DM. You're doing a great job. Keep doing it. But every table is different. And usually it's usually going to fall closer to the middle where you play mostly by the rules, but maybe you have a homebrew class or feature, or maybe you do crits different than the rules or whatever the case may be. But if it's working for you and your table, good job. You're a great DM. Keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the good things about TTRPGs and D&D is that for all the hundreds of hours of content on this podcast, and I'm sure thousands of hours of content you've produced, you can distill it down to that quite elegant, like, is everybody having fun? Yes or no? Yes. Right. Yep. Good. And
perfect.
There are different levels of fun and everyone can still be having more fun, but that's what the purpose of the show is to just ignite those flames of inspiration to be like, oh yeah, I never thought about that. Or maybe I could add that in, or maybe I won't do all of that, but maybe I'll just take that one little piece. And that's the why I love the show and having people such as yourselves on, is to have those discussions and provide those little perspectives and point of views and tips and tricks that I definitely would never have thought of.
Well, and to kind of counter my own argument, because again, we've been doing this a long time, is that even if you're having an amazing session, like you said, that doesn't mean you can't have a better session. Like you may be everybody has so much fun, but you don't even know that there's more fun to be had. So we still encourage people to improve, try things. Like if you are someone who will fudge a die without thinking, try a session where you don't. If you're someone who's never fudged a die, maybe try one time you do, just to see how it works. Hopefully it's not a campaign destroying friendship ending situation. Maybe it's probably something a little bit less, you know, important at that particular moment. If you're someone who uses maps and minis, try a Theater of the Mind battle. If you only do Theater of Mind, try a map and mini battle. But mostly what I would say to improve your DMing, my two biggest tips are play other games. I also run a small gaming convention, like 400 or 500 people once a year. Go to a convention and play every game you can that's not the game you normally play. So if you're the DM for your D&D campaign, play 5 other games as players, not D&D. Play story games, play sci-fi games, play Call of Cthulhu. You're going to take things from those games, little elements, whether it be a mechanic, like a rule, a tip, something about tone or theme or whatever, and it will probably make you better at running D&D. And I'll be honest, sometimes having a bad experience makes you a better D&D DM, because you're like, oh, that was terrible. I had a horrible time this game because the DM kept doing this. I'm going to make sure I never do those things. That still is you improving. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would tell you to do is to record your games. Does not mean you're going to start a podcast, though everyone does these days. It's really easy. You should do it if you want to. But I cannot tell you how valuable listening back to yourself running a game can be to help you improve. So one, you don't have to worry about taking notes. You're going to remember what accent you used for that NPC. You remember what name you made up in the spot for that NPC. You're going to remember all the clues you made up. Oh, it's a left-handed killer who's taller than the victim. But you're going to be able to hear where your players are totally engaged and they're excited about what's happening. You're going to hear where you stumble. You're going to hear where you have to repeat yourself 3 times because no one understood what was going on. You had to re-clarify. They didn't pick up this clue and they were completely off base 30 minutes into the game. You are absolutely going to pick up on all those details. So that is one of my biggest tips for anyone. Record your sessions, even if it's just for you, and listen back to them.
Yeah, I've never thought, I mean, despite streaming some of my games, I have never once gone back to, and also despite misremembering and definitely forgetting accents 100 times over. That is, I think you can do it quite easily in Discord and stuff, or even just if you're in person with a microphone on the on the table, right?
So if you're not going to podcast it, it doesn't have to be good audio, just as long as you can hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't believe I've never heard that one before. Well done, Michael. That's a first.
All right, that's it. I'm out. I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. See, thanks everyone for having me on, man.
Yeah, it's fine. Really short episode this week. Boom, done. Good night. I wanted to briefly talk about now the kind of... I've run two things that that could be considered mysteries, quote unquote, like the closest that I've come to that. So we'll start with the one that's slightly further away. And the reason why I'll explain it is not only for the listeners' benefit, but to see, you know, get your take on it as well. See, sure. You know, your thoughts. Maybe I could have done better, I could have done worse, or maybe other things that maybe it's inspiration for you as well. Who knows? But one of my favorite games is Outer Wilds. Couple of years ago, maybe 2019 or something, and there's no combat or anything. The whole gimmick of the game is that it's all based on the knowledge of the player, and as your knowledge improves, you can then progress with the story, and everything's in place at the start. All the variables are set at the start, everything's there, all the tools are there and available at the start. It's just you don't know how they work together or how to use them, so they're just these random elements that mean nothing to you till you've done some exploring and worked it out. So I wanted to emulate that feeling because I really loved it, really loved the game, and I wanted to emulate that feeling that the game gave me for my players, of that same kind of situation of like, oh, okay, so now if we do X and then Y and then Z, then we'll be able to open the door or something like that. And it's just like, oh, I was there all along, and now we can shortcut and blah blah blah. So the premise of Outer Wilds is it's a time loop. It's like 22 minutes and then it resets. And that's how you keep having the knowledge and you can go back to step one and go through it with a new knowledge again. So I did the same thing with 30 minutes in the past, but it's a kind of Star Wars a long time ago. So it's in the past, but it was mechanically and futuristic, more settings with automatic doors and so on, lifts again, funnily enough, and so on and so on. But one thing I did to really reduce the number of variables, and you mentioned it earlier around the player's abilities, and I know my players are creative and I know my players are inventive, and I know that there's no way I could give them that feeling while still having them have all their abilities. So my mechanic was part of the time travel process. It was like a quantum leap thing. So they embodied bodies of somebody, you know, other people while they were there, thereby stripping them of their powers. So I must admit, telling the barbarian blood hunter min-maxer that his strength it was now only 10 and not 20 was painful. the sadness on his face. But I was like, sorry dude, you can still punch things and you still kind of you I might give you a little bonus because you know how to punch things as well as just being physically strong, but it needs to be a level playing field. It needs to be on your brain power only, as it were. Super risky, stripping mm-hmm. them, you know, of everything. No polymorph for the druid. No, you know, spells. No charm person for the warlock. No, you know, plus six strength for the barbarian. And actually, they really, really, really enjoyed it. I was very happy to say they came out of the side and was like, yeah, that was really memorable, really interesting, quite different. Happy to get back to the comfort of my class that I know and love, but for those 7-8 sessions, I think it was 11 sessions in the end, that was very memorable. And yeah, it was going back in time. They had a broad idea of what had happened, but they had to piece it together and, oh, well, that happens at 11 minutes past, so I can, you know, accost that person, take his security card, that gets me through that door at 11 minutes past. What can I do in the first 10 minutes there to, you know, that kind of stuff. So I don't know if you've done anything similar or have got any thoughts on that, or have I committed a cardinal sin of stripping my players of their
it reminds me, there's a movie, Live, Die, Repeat, the Tom mm-hmm. Cruise yep. movie, where basically every time he dies, he resets and goes through. And yeah, that's a mm-hmm. classic video game sort of conceit. So I have the worst example of doing something similar that I went through. Because I do, as a DM, I like to experiment. I want to try different things. And so my setup quickly is when I do a new campaign Like each game, I prepare very little. Like I go into each game with just a very small inkling of what's going to happen. I'm very improv friendly. I'll just roll with the punches. But before we ever play the first session, I do lots and lots and lots of planning and world building so that I kind of know what's happening big picture. So it makes it easier to improvise in the middle. But it's also a process where I involve the players and I ask them to like create backstories and create NPCs. So we went through this very involved process that took, you know, it was probably a month over text and emails, maybe a couple Zoom calls, and we were like fleshing out this world. And I had everybody create multiple NPCs, but one in particular we really focused on. And they just really did a good job of creating this NPC and really fleshing them out and how their character knew the player's character. So we start the actual campaign. And the first session was like a little tiny one shot, beginning, middle, and end. And it ended with them defeating this evil like creature in the swamp, but they were all covered in this like ichor. And then The next session, when they showed up, I'm like, okay, you're now playing this character. You're now playing this character. And I basically gave them the NPC sheets that they had created because when they wake up, all their players are gone. The player characters have disappeared. It's a mystery. No one knows where they are. So you're now playing these NPCs trying to find your players. I thought it was brilliant. My players revolted. They hated it. Hated it. It actually killed the campaign. Like we stopped playing it because they hated it so bad. And my fundamental flaw is I didn't explain what was going on. Like I thought the surprise factor of you playing these NPCs that you had created and you had some investment in would be compelling enough to drive them forward. But they were all like, I built a paladin. I want to play a paladin. I don't want to play this tree farmer. Mm. And I didn't explain that this was temporary. I didn't explain that we would be jumping back and forth. And eventually, you know, pretty quickly, you would learn where your players actually were. And it would be like a two-sided thing where you would be trying to get out while they were trying to rescue you and they would come together. Mm-hmm. So what I would have learned from here, and I would apply to yours as well, is I would have at least told them ahead of time what the plan was, why I'm doing it, and that it is temporary. Like you were not, your characters are not dead. You're going to get back to playing them. But there's a reason why I want you to do this. So please humor me if you're not having the most fun. I think it will be worth it in the end. And I still could have been wrong, but I think not trusting my players enough to have them trust me that there's a reason we're doing this. It's going to be fun. Just go with it. I thought the surprise of, your characters are gone would override their disappointment. And at least for my group, it did not.
Mm-hmm. Now, you touched upon a really good point there about that trust between the players and the DMs. And I think a lot of problems and a lot of horror stories you hear, you know, outside of just, you know, the topic of today's show, mystery, and in general in TTRPGs, is because there isn't that trust between the players and the DMs. And it's obviously hard to build. And obviously if you're playing with randoms online, it doesn't start there. But a lot of things like we've both discussed, they require an element, you know, quite a large degree of trust, in fact, between the players and DM. And there's no way I would have done that in the first year of playing, even though I knew the guys, I was working with them for years, you know, my colleagues worked with them daily. Many of them were friends as well. Even still, I would not have done that. I did give them a heads up. I was like, look, the next couple of sessions are going to be very different. I'm trying something experimental that I've never done before. So it's going to be different. Just bear with me and we'll see how it goes. So I didn't explicitly tell them, you're going to lose all your weapons and abilities and that we just spent 4 years gathering. But I was like, it's good. Quite different. I'm pretty sure you should find it enjoyable. But yeah, it's that trust. Like there is so much there that you need this unspoken trust. So like, I'm very fortunate in the game that I'm a player in. I have huge amounts of respect and trust for our DM. And also the benefit of experience of DMing myself. So those two things combined, I think, is why they keep having me back at the table despite doing no post-production or any support to the podcast. I just turn up and play.
Just play. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
It is. It's wonderful. but it's because I'm like, oh, I can tell what he's trying to do here and I trust him to pull it off. So my character's going to act in this manner. And I think likewise, I think if he was here, he would say he would trust me and my character to operate in that kind of way. But you just don't, you know, that doesn't just happen at session zero. That doesn't happen in session 10. That takes a while to build up. And I think a lot of problems people have is because they're playing these random games or, you know, pickup groups or just rock up every week, which it can be absolutely fun. But right. I think you don't have the implicit trust there because you don't know that person. You don't know their skill set. You don't know, are they just going to take away your characters and do something else or right. anything weird? And I've just been rambling about how great I am, but that is...
Well, someone has to say it, so it might as well be you.
Damn right, yeah.
So I would just kind of roll that trust back into, just to quickly touch on like the fudging thing again quickly, is like I play with a lot of I play with a lot of variety of people through the podcast. We do one-shots and one-offs and they're open invites. But I also have a group that I generally play with, you know, campaign play style. And at least for my campaigns, I'm very open about the fact that I will fudge dice. Like I'm just 100% open aboard. I will do it if I feel it's necessary. Though in truth, I very rarely do. Like I have enough experience, and like you were touching on, there's all these dials that I can twist and turn to sort of change the way things are happening. And just ignoring the result on a die is one of those tools, but it's one of the least elegant. Like I have lots of ways that I can change things, whether it's just make the bad guys do dumb things and not do the most tactically advanced thing, not use their best spell. Lots of ways around it. But for me, ignoring a die roll is one of the tools in my toolbox. And like any tool in a toolbox, some people will overuse it, some people will never use it, some people will misuse it. But for me, it is a tool in the toolbox. But I have an understanding with my long-term campaign players that every decision I make, whether it's to turn a dial, change the number of enemies, change the number of hit points, not use a spell, use a spell, fudge a die, is based on my belief that it will be more fun for them. It is never about, the integrity of the story I'm trying to tell. If you haven't paid attention, I don't have a story I'm trying to tell. Usually I'm improv and making stuff up as we go. I didn't even know this bad guy was showing up today. You told me he was. So it's not like I need them to live for any particular reason. But in the moment, I'm making a decision that I think will be the most fun for everyone at the table. And there will be times I'm wrong. So there will be times I shouldn't have doubled hit points. There aren't times when I shouldn't have halved hit points. There are times when I shouldn't have fudged to die. But I think over the long run, I have built trust with my players that I'm doing this for the benefit of the entire group. And I have their best interest at heart. That's the only reason I'm doing it. So even when it doesn't go perfectly, they're still there. Well, I know what you were trying to do. That might've been a mistake, but it's not going to affect us long-term. We're going to come back and play again next week type of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's probably one of the most important things is that trust, that rapport you build. And yeah, on every session, I'm just lucky that, both I have my players and the DM in my other game that I have that trust with.
Because playing games is fun, right? Like, that's why we do it. It's fun. Like, that is the only stick I have for games. Did I have fun? Yes, it was a great game. No, could have been better. Like, that's it. That's the only measuring stick I have for games. Are they fun?
Oh, that reminded me. Talking about fudging dice again, you've reminded me of a question I wanted to ask. This will put you on the spot slightly.
Okay.
But I've got to play both sides of an argument. So we're talking more about, you know, the villain, the perpetrator, once the players have kind of put enough pieces together, the person they think it is would be the person, because we're mentioning it up on the fly and stuff. Some people would say that leaves too much power in the hands of the DM to arbitrarily decide when the players have done enough. Mm-hmm. And enough is what exactly? So I don't know, what are your thoughts on that style of mystery and that particular feedback?
So I'm going to take out the fact that we're running a module. So we're going to assume that we're doing homebrew for this sort of counter argument to your prompt here. So when I sat down to write this murder mystery, I had 100% complete control over everything. I decided what setting this would be in, who the NPCs would be, what the method of death would be, what clues they would find. Like, I planned every single thing out in detail. But I did it in a vacuum. I didn't actually know what was going to happen at the table. I didn't necessarily know which players were not going to be there that night, or which ones were had a bad day at work and they weren't really engaged, which one was going to forget what spells they had. So my belief is that if I am changing things on the fly, that is me adapting to real-time information, that if I had had that information when I was prepping, I would have included it then. So to me, there's no difference in me writing down three ogres are going to attack than there is me going, Well, in the moment, it's going to be four because Steve's dice are on fire and he's just going to slaughter the first one in round one. Or three ogres are going to attack. Oh, crap. They're almost dead. I'm just going to forget the third one was there. Now it's just two. Like, I am updating my planning real time based on actual information rather than doing it in a vacuum. To me, those are exactly the same process as long as they're all done with the standpoint of I'm creating an encounter because I think it'll be fun. I think it'll be challenging, but rewarding. Or in some cases, I make an easy encounter because I want them to feel like badasses and I want them to wipe out everything. And sometimes I want it to be really hard where if they don't make good choices, they may have to run away. So me making those choices in the game is just part of my prep moved into real time based on new information. So to me, they're exactly the same.
Ooh, nice comeback on that. Yeah.
I've had these discussions before. If you're not aware, the whole idea of fudging, not fudging is a huge like contention in the RPG space online. So yeah, there's lots of opportunities to like think about this. And again, just to restate it, if you're someone who doesn't agree with me, you're not wrong for you. But when you tell me I'm wrong, that's when you become wrong.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing I've done was, I know I said I've never done it before, but my players were tasked with disposing of a person of interest in the, you know, a philanthropist, a, you know, famous minor celebrity in the city, and that they were hosting a, like a masquerade ball. And that would be a good time to do it. Very cliche, I know. Yep.
Execution matters. The most cliche story in the world can be tons of fun if you do it well. So don't ever worry about leaning into cliches.
Mm-hmm. Now, as it turns out, this guy was obviously had some dark other things, which is why they wanted him out of the picture. So it was kind of justified in a way. But my players are a loosey-goosey with good morals. And bad anyway, as it is. So I wasn't too precious about that. But yes, they faff around. They find ways to get in. They forge tickets. They steal a couple of tickets. They have enough for the whole party to get in. Blah blah blah. They end up turning up legitimately with legitimate tickets rather than climbing through a second or third story window or whatever it may be. And philanthropist is at the top of the stairs and he's like, "Oh, you know, welcome everybody to my exciting masquerade party tonight." But the gimmick of that was that he was running a. It's a bit like, funnily enough, Glass Onion, in that he was running a murder mystery. Actually, I preceded Glass Onion, so they stole my idea.
Yeah,
I think so. And he was doing murder mystery, so he's talking at the top of the stairs, and all the players are watching, and like, okay, that's the guy we've got to get to, but we'll come to that later. He gets stabbed through the back, so the sword, you know, comes out the middle of his chest, and he's like, and collapses. And everyone screams and the lights turn out and it goes into chaos and the player's like, "Oh my God, is it done? Can we leave? Do we need, that doesn't sound right." You know, that
problem
that
solved,
kind of stuff.
Time to get paid.
Yeah. Easy job, easy money. So that's what I did. Unfortunately, I didn't do too much of the whole, you know, who's out to get him. Well, I heard he owed money to this person, or, you know, like in Glass Onion, all of them have got some weird reason to hate the person.
Mm-hmm.
Edward Norton's character, for whatever it may be. I didn't do too much of that because I just presumed my players would brute force it, and they kind of did in a way. So that's almost like two murder mysteries layered on top of each other, because you've got the fake one and then you've got the real one that the players are going to commit, which is interesting. So yes, that's what I did. Definitely could have been done better. As I said, like, I probably could have lent more onto the fake murder mystery experience a little bit more, because that was it. That's pretty much all I had planned, and then they disappeared and went out of the party, and the players had to find them chilling out upstairs at some point. But then that was it. There was just, everything else was just kind of filler in the way. Right. It wasn't really making part of, wasn't adding to the mystery in a way. But as I said, luckily, as we said, they enjoyed it. So that's the most important thing, I suppose. So
and actually, that's
one of the most, thank you. And that is, again, something they've remembered out. All the interactions they've had with NPCs, the bloody 50 pages of NPCs they've met, that one and the time loop one are two that they remember, you know, all of them remember well. You know, sometimes, as you said, some people have had a bad day and they're not quite there, they don't remember it. Totally fine. I don't care. Like, most sessions you're gonna have something like that where someone doesn't remember, "Oh yeah, we did speak to that person." I do it all the time.
Oh, yeah,
as a player.
Of course.
I'm like, "Give me that recap because I have forgotten." But those two situations, funnily enough, were two that all of them remembered.
Right. So I have two quick things. Something you said sparked one. So remind me about my LARP. But the other thing is, one of the things that I will do in my games is I will often ask the players to recap what happened last session. And mm-hmm. this lets me remember or figure out what they thought was important. So like if I was like, one of the key details of this mystery is the left-handedness of the murderer, right? If I ask them to recap it and they don't include the fact that the murderer was left-handed, then that's something I can address in that session. And rather than me just saying, oh, you forgot, I can just have it come back up. Like when someone's going over the mm-hmm. clues, like, well, here were the clues you found again. And it doesn't seem like it's such an important detail that they then know that it's super important. But the fact that they didn't include it in the recap tells me I need to reintroduce it into the story again. So I'm a big fan of asking them to do recaps. Usually, we rotate, this person does it this week, this person does it that week. Mm-hmm. I just think that's a very helpful, again, it's a DMing tool to figure out, okay, they completely forgot this thing, or they are way too focused on this thing. It's just like a little mm-hmm. Help sheet for each session. But one of the events that I run at my convention every year is a D&D inspired murder mystery LARP. Again, I love mysteries.
Awesome.
And one of the conceits that I built into that to kind of solve not the problem that you had, but the concern you had, is that in mind, there's a murder mystery, and the captain of the guard seals everyone in the castle, and no one can leave until the murderer is caught. But I expressly say, you don't have to find the actual killer. You have to build enough evidence to convince everyone else here that that person did it. And they're all trying to do the same thing. So if you don't want to be the one that's convicted, you've got to find evidence on someone else. It usually turns out they find the right person, but they don't have to. So that could have been something you could have built into yours, where it's not just that they have to murder the person, but they have to frame a different person, whether it be a specific person or just anybody. Like, there's like seven people on the council. One of the seven on the council has to be the person that gets framed for the murder. So that encourages them to not just go in and stab the person. They have got to talk to people. They've got to do research, because that's now part of the prompt, not just murder. It's murder and frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm probably going to run my whole campaign again at some point. So these provide a lot of value, these kind of discussions, because it all gets folded in and locked away. That sounds awesome, that convention. If I ever find myself in that part of the world, I'm going to...
It's Dayton, Ohio. November is a terrible place to be, but if you are unfortunately there, come look us up.
I was just trying to think. I felt like there was one more thing to add there on my... In that example with the mystery ball, they were tier 2, I think. So they had some powerful abilities, but it wasn't still quite just like, I see into the future and see through all the walls and there he is and I float up to him and kill him and this, that, and the other. They ended up chucking him in a bag of holding, taking him to a different off-site location to to deal with him in the end, and used the fake murder mystery as like, the getaway vehicle, almost the hiding in plain sight, almost. So, yes, that worked out quite well.
I do really like that twist. I got to say, the idea of having to commit a murder at a ball that's actually a murder mystery ball is really good. Like, so props to you on coming up with that one before Ryan Johnson.
The first person in the world, I'm sure, to have come up with that idea is me. Absolutely, quote me on that. no, don't, because I'll get sued. by some sick author in the ancient Greece that has definitely thought of the same thing. So yeah, that's pretty much it. Those two were the two kind of, we're putting together knowledge, we're building it together a piece of a picture, or even creating the pieces in the case of the second example. But yeah, I think as we've said several times, the players had fun. I mainly had fun, apart from the usual DM stress and anxiety of, dear God, what's happening here? So yeah, have you got any examples that are similar to that that are probably better implemented then in terms of those mysterious things? Or actually, let me rephrase the question. How do you instill a sense of mystery then? Maybe on a more grander scale. So it's very easy to have like, there's a dead body. We don't know who killed him. Find out. That's the definition, right? Dictionary definition of a mystery. But in terms of like, more of a campaign setting, in the same way that Curse of Strahd is very gothic and horror, how do we go about building a campaign or a setting that is more mysterious and full of noir and things like that?
So the probably the first thing that comes to my mind is going back to that open communication and just telling the players, hey, this session or this series of games or this campaign, I envision this as a very mystery-centric campaign. So mm-hmm. I'm like, lay out some of the tropes, like there's going to be red herrings, there's going to be double crosses, there's going to be multiple missing people or murders. And if your players are excited about that, they will lean into the tropes and they will start doing the work for you. So they are going to say, oh, this is probably a red herring, but I'm going to chase it down anyways, because that's what would happen in this type of story. Or I'm going to go off on my own, because there's always that part in the story where the person goes off alone and they are probably going to be attacked by the murderer. That will allow us to figure out some more information. So if they buy into what you're trying to do, they will help you. And rather than the DM having to orchestrate everything like a omniscient puppeteer, which we are not, sometimes we try to be and it's hard to do. If your players are like helping you, it's just so much easier.
Mm-hmm. Get your players to help you. That's tip of the one of the many several tips that's been in this episode is get your players to help you, but without them knowing, boom, that's the sneaky is there anything you wanted to talk about that we haven't quite hit yet, that we haven't got to?
So just there are other games that handle mysteries differently, and you know, as someone who loves D&D, it's still my favorite game. I've played dozens if not hundreds of systems now, but D&D is still the one I come back to. It's still my favorite. I call it the Waffle House of RPGs. I don't know if you're familiar with Waffle House being in the UK. It's sort of like a diner. And is it the best food? No, but it does lots of different foods really well. So like if you have someone who wants spaghetti, another person who wants a hamburger, and another person who wants breakfast food, you can all go to Waffle House and you'll have a pretty good meal. But you're not going to get sushi. You're not going to get a 5-star steak there, right? So there are games that were developed specifically to handle mysteries. And if you really like mysteries, maybe play those games, or at least try them, and then you can steal things. There's Gumshoe is one of the big ones, because what can happen in D&D, if you're not careful, is that the players will miss clues because of bad skill checks. Like if you expect them to investigate the crime scene and learn that the victim was shorter than their assailant, that you lock that behind a skill check and they fail it, they don't get that information. So then they don't know that. And it's just, you're going to have a harder time laying out a successful mystery if they can't find clues. So at games like Gumshoe, you don't roll to find the clues. You're just given the clues based off of how you approach the scene. So if someone's really good at insight, they might be the one talking to the witnesses and they will garner, oh, well, I did see something. It looked like this taller figure came out of the shadows, but then disappeared. Or if they're more forensics, then there might be something about the blood splatter or where the weapon was found or how the body was laid or the angle of the incision of the blade, whatever. So you don't lock your clues behind a skill check, because then you can not get them and it can be a problem. There's a newer game that just came out called Brindlewood Bay. Are you familiar with that one?
No.
So this is it's a Powered by the Apocalypse style game where the conceit is you're playing basically Murder, She Wrote meets Golden Girls meets Call of Cthulhu. So all the players are part of what's called the Mystery Mavens Mystery Society. You're lovers of this book series that's sort of like a Hercule Poirot or Agatha Christie style novel. But you also get asked by the local law enforcement, the bumbling sheriff, to help solve actual murder mysteries. And over campaign play, there starts to become this underlying supernatural element that's not revealed in the first standpoint. So you have moves, if you're familiar with Powered by the Apocalypse, to help uncover clues. That game is interesting because the idea that we don't know who the murderer is player-facing. So the DM doesn't go into the mystery knowing who the murderer is, but you uncover clues. And then at some point, everyone, including the DM, get together and go, well, based off the clues we have, it must be this person. And so it's player-centric, player-facing, that you figure it out based off the clues. It wasn't decided. I actually didn't like that element. Like if the DM had decided that the clues made sense here and we thought it made sense and the DM said, yeah, you're right, I would have enjoyed it more. The actual player-facing part didn't work for me, but it obviously other people it does. So again, just circle back, try some of these other games that are really based on mysteries. And if you still want to play D&D, just incorporate some of those elements. So the biggest for me is the clues. You can't lock clues behind skill checks in a murder mystery. because then you're almost guaranteed that they're going to miss something. You have to find a way of either more clues if they roll well, but there's like a baseline minimum, like even if they botch the roll, they get something. Or maybe even just, again, base it off, if they're talking to witnesses, they're going to get a clue of this level. If they check the crime scene, they'll get a level, this type of thing. So you can still reward them for smart play or for rolling well. But that's the ultimate sin of a D&D murder mystery is, oh, I got a 10 on my spot. We don't know something. And now the game just comes to a crashing halt. You have to find a way around that.
Yeah. Alongside the, oh, well, how could I ever have guessed that? Its evil brother is, well, there's nothing for us to guess because we just don't know anything.
We just do not know something. So, yeah.
Yeah, those two are the equally bad, I wouldn't say fail states, cause that's too strong a word, because you can always recover, but
roadblocks.
They're the two paths, that require more work to work your way out of. But that, we've all done it. Like, every DM at some point in their career has gone, oh, roll with advantage because it's sunny outside and I really need you to pass this one. So it's you're feeling good because it's sunny, so roll again.
Yeah, 100% it happens. Even best of us do the same thing. But what I would say is just whoever has the highest spot, you just tell them, well, looking at the crime scene, you notice this, but you can roll and maybe get something better. Like, I will have baseline clues that my players will get just because their characters are the heroes of the story. They are the exceptional people. The bumbling detectives didn't notice this, but because you have a +5 insight, you notice it right away. But if you roll really good, I'll give you additional clues.
Mm-hmm. One question I have for you in overtime. Sure. If you'll excuse me, and it's
happy
this is a genuine one. A genuine one I want to know is, do you always stick with the facts when you relay information to the players, or do you do some inference on their behalf? So do you always say the incision was 3 centimeters from their back shoulder blade and 4 centimeters, from the spine, and that's it? Or do you say that implies they were attacked from behind, from a person who's shorter than them, because it was only at that point on the back? Where do you, which end of the scale?
Again, going back to that 3-clue rule we started at the beginning, I have found over my many, many years of running games that even the most obvious things to me as the DM can sometimes be shrouded to the players. Like, I'm like, it's very clear who the bad guy is here. And they're like, I just don't know. So I will often infer those types of things, like, it, based off the wound, this looks like someone that was like savagely attacked. There's anger behind it. This wasn't like a cold, calculated assassination. This is someone who wanted vengeance. Like, I will fill in those types of details. If the players are like, I'll give them a moment. Like, I'll give them the beat that, it appears that this is what it looks like. And if they go, well, so the attacker had to have been taller then, like, yeah, you could definitely tell that. And then I might embellish a little bit more if they're not doing those sorts of things. Like, maybe the hilt of the blade made a bruise mark to show that how savagely it was punching. I don't know. I'm not actually a forensics, doctor or whatever. But so I start with little, but then I will add if they're not doing it themselves, because I think that's part of the mystery thing, is where the Sherlock's like, they were savagely attacked by someone who they knew, it's hard to get that across with a math.
Players aren't like players often, maybe some players out there are, but most players aren't police detective inspectors. So they cannot, like, we don't inherently have that skill set of been in the force for 40 years. So I think there needs to be some helping hand. And of course, the risk as well is that, and I've done it, I've tried to be good and not infer anything or not assume, you feel like this. No, I've tried in the past not to do any of that stuff and just stick to the objective facts. But that runs the risk of, because humans, we're all different and we all see things and interpret things and experience things differently, the players assuming something wildly off, which then puts them down some path that is just completely. So instead of that incision implying that the killer was taller because they could get at that angle, they've gone, oh, it must be a ranged weapon from somewhere up high. So maybe the killer was up over there rather than stabbing them in the back. And then the DM's like, oh God, no, that's don't do that. So that, and it's often harder to kind of pull them back. And of course, there's a school of thought that says, well, no, that's what you run with then. You run with the ranged marksman up on the building opposite. which I get, yeah, again, if you have the capacity to do so, yeah, some games that would work for, but.
Yeah, I think there is there's a fine line to like, I guess to clarify, like I used to do the things where I would say your character is afraid. This is like a very simple mm-hmm. example. I do not do that anymore because that's player's agency. And even though they're in a scene where their characters should be afraid if they're reasonable people, if that player wants to say, well, no, I'm the one that's very stoic, and even in the face of unrelenting fear, I am the one who doesn't feel fear. Okay, great. That's your character. So I will say things like, it's very likely that a person would feel fear in this moment, but I still allow the players to decide for themselves how their characters feel in the moment. So just again, as a very easy example. Yeah. So the same thing with like the attacks, like I probably wouldn't infer their like you feel sick to your stomach at seeing how savagely this person was attacked. That's I'm pushing on their character, but I would say this appears to have been a very savage attack. The person wanted the victim to feel pain, not just die. Because I still think mm-hmm. we're in the realms of facts, but we're embellishing a little bit of like motivation or something to the attacker, not to the player. So it is a fine line, but I do see a difference there. And I agree with that. I try not to push how the players feel or think, but I might give them additional information on what the killer was thinking or feeling.
Yeah, it is an art form. Like it is very tricky to walk that thin line between giving away too much and not giving away enough that the players get frustrated and confused. Yeah. It is, you know, it's one of those things that for all our talking for this over an hour, like experience does a lot of a heavy lifting, and which is why, as you said, try new systems and try new things, because that's how you get that experience. Then at the other side, you go, oh, okay, I've been in this situation before. I need to give them a little bit more here. Mm-hmm. And I just want to finish on the talking about not telling players how they feel. The ironic thing is I played in a game once where one of the players was like, I don't know if my character would run away or not. DM, would my character run away? And mm-hmm. he was like, well, you can roll for it if you want, but like, right. That's a you decision. Yeah. So it can go both ways. You know, there are sometimes players out there that like, I just don't know. I need the dice, or I need someone else to help me.
That's in my experience pretty rare, but I actually have seen something mm-hmm. similar. In my case, yes. My advice there as a DM, I'd say, okay, have them roll a saving throw. Like yeah. That's kind of the mechanic for that. If I was trying to cause like a magical fear, there's a saving throw to resist. So I would just say, do the same thing here. This is a saving throw, DC, yeah. Whatever. If you pass, you don't have to run away. If you fail, you will.
Mm-hmm. Yep, precisely. Another tool in the belt and tool mm-hmm. in the toolbox. Well, thank you for today. But is there anything you would like to plug or promote?
I absolutely would. Again, I don't exactly know when this is going to come out, but I have my first game that I wrote coming to Kickstarter at the end of February, February 28th. It's going to run for about 3 weeks. It's going to end on March 22nd, I believe. And if this comes out after, that's totally fine. There'll still be ways to, you know, people to support it and get it. But it is a game called Action 12 Cinema. And it is a love letter to three of my favorite things: bad but yet fun action movies, the D12, which is the pinnacle of the polyhedral. It's the most fun die to roll at the table, and collaborative storytelling. So, again, hopefully it came across in this interview or this discussion. I love improv storytelling at the table. It's one of my favorite things to do, both as a player and a DM. So I've taken those three things together, mushed them together in a GM-less game. So there is no GM, or basically everybody's the GM, where you tell these just over-the-top action movie stories. So think any of the Fast and the Furious movies, RRR would be a good movie. Mm-hmm. Those are probably both better movies than the stories that my game tells. They're more like B or C level, but that sort of over-the-top, anything can happen. People can like pick up a motorcycle and slap someone with it, even though they're not super strong. Those are the types of things that can happen in this game. I would love people to check it out, hopefully support against. It's my first time actually writing an actual game beginning to middle and end. I'm very excited about sharing it. There's a few places you can like listen to games being played. Some streams are out there. But if you just go to the RPG Academy on anywhere, generally Twitter, that's where I'm most active. I'm sure there'll be links in my bios and pinned tweets and everything. But I'd love for people to check it out.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds great. I love 80s and 90s action films. Yep. They're fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. I'm all over that. Well, the timing should be perfect. And for those that are interested, the links will be in the episode description. So I would encourage everybody to go and check that out and support Michael. Otherwise, for real this time, the only thing that's left to say is thank you ever so much, Michael. That was really, a really interesting discussion. And we talked about a whole bunch of very useful, interesting things somehow still within the realm of mystery. So thank you so much.
I had a blast. Thank you for having me. It really was a good time.
My pleasure. Thanks to everyone for listening at home, of course. Please do check out all of our socials and the links in the episode description below. Otherwise, thank you all for listening and good night. Now it's time for the Patreon shoutouts. Huge thank you to all my patrons, starting with Josh, Lee Winika, and Glenn, the three fabulous hosts of Tabletop Journeys who've been on the show several times before and who I'll always invite back. So go check out Tabletop Journeys at ttjourneys.com or at ttjourneys on Twitter. We also have Joe from the Fourth Leg podcast all about giving DMs another leg to stand on. Again, previous guests of the show, and I'd thoroughly encourage you to go and check out their great content. So you can find them at The Fourth Leg on Twitter. We also have a good friend of the show, Optional Rule. You can go and find him out on optionalrule.com or at Optional Rule, full of very insightful and educated comments and thoughts and threads on the really nitty-gritty of D&D. We have what a guy, Matthew Perkins, who is just out there in the world trying to make you laugh. So go and check him out at MatthewPerkins.net or at Hey, it's Matty P, M-A-T-T-Y-P. And good friend of the show and one of my table mates, Matthew Street. Go and check out his partner's hustle at virtualtimehustle.com or at MPStreet88 on Twitter.